So I am a very seat of the pants author. And there are a lot of ways in which that has been fine for me. But what I've learned in the past, like probably 6 months, a year, is you can't do it entirely. I pulled away from that really hard when I first started writing a lot of fiction, because I had seen so many people get caught up in world building that they did not actually get around to writing any stories. And then over the past, you know, seven novels, I just finished up seven, I realized that there are failings. I needed to actually stop every so often and go, where am I at? Where am I going? What's going to make sense to get me from point A to point B? And I really needed to get that down on paper more.
This is the Crit RPG Podcast, your one-stop shop for everything Lit RPG, Progression Fantasy, and Royal Road. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Crit RPG Podcast, the only podcast where the guests butter up the host before the show starts. With me today is RC Joshua, who has been buttering me up before the show started. But yeah, we've been recording 1 hour and 9 minutes of bonus material that you can find on Patreon. But if you don't, well, stick around. And we're going to be talking for at least an hour more about writing and all that kind of stuff. Josh, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. It's late here. But it's already here. That's my fault for living on the wrong continent.
Yes. You're living in the past. We've talked about this too. Yes. It is unfortunate. I can give you next week's lotto numbers if you want.
Well, I want to earn it.
Okay. That's good. That's a spirit. There you go. Suffering.
How's it going? All right. Where you're at.
So, as I said before, I am for once actually short on time when we're doing these things.
Oh, yeah.
So we need to be very, very focused. Focused on this podcast. Yeah, that's a good one. Anyway, tell us about your stories. Pitch us your stories. Why and how did you write those stories?
Okay. So most of my stories come from a point of view of really focusing in on the escapism part of Lit RPG. So at the beginning of every story, I'm setting up a character who has a problem in our current Earth. So for the first book I wrote, Dead World Isekai, it's a character who is having their life cut short. And it's a character who has cancer, who dies of cancer. And when they get isekai'd, reincarnated, transmigrated, however you think of it, they're initially given a promise. I'm sending you to a beautiful planet, a garden planet, someplace that you can actually work and see your work grow, and it's going to be this beautiful place. And when he actually gets there, it's that promise is broken to him. He's on a completely barren world, dead world. But starting from that place of, here's this person who is a lot like you. Here's this person who has a real problem that this world promises to solve. And then having that promise broken, I think is what I was focusing on when I wrote that one. How to Survive, which was the second series, focused on a character who was not as successful as he should be. I think a lot of people who read Lit RPG have what at least Americans call smart kid syndrome, where they were very promising young people for whom the world didn't pan out quite like it seemed it was. That character came from that place and then moved into a world where there was more opportunity for success, less broken promises, but like something to work, you could pour his work towards that would matter. And those more relevant for the third book, and just give a reason for those two. Dead World was written in a time where I was horrifyingly depressed. And somebody said, what are you working on next? And I said, a guy who's going to be alone with broken promises in a dark, dreary, empty world, struggling to survive.
Ah, yes.
And I was going through that as I wrote that book. And then How to Survive was more about like my past, just like jobs that didn't fit and a world that hadn't worked out quite like I had planned as far as success went. And then the most recent book, which is Demon World Boba Shop, is completely fluffy, nice slice of life stuff, which I chose to write because I was, you know, writing game is hard. Yeah. And I was starting to get stressed out with a lot of it and had to focus in on a guy who started out on Earth in a stressy way, working too hard, and then went to a place where nothing bad, really bad things can happen, but everything always turns out right.
Yeah. You know? So, I feel that so hard.
That's at least what drove those premises. Like the books are long and involved and chapter by chapter. Why I'm writing what I write changes a lot, but I think that's what drove those three books specifically. Where I started out from and why I decided to write it.
I can relate to all of them. Right. Except that I didn't write the Broken Promise one yet. Mm. Oh, well, I did, but it's not on Royal Road. I have taken down some notes because actually I think there's so much to talk about here. But the Demon Boba Shop one, I was disappointed that you didn't call it a Bubble of Life story.
I'll put it in a blurb somewhere.
Please do. in the blubber. Anyway, no, but I've been thinking about this for a while, ever since one of my guests mentioned, like, hey, is there any like spiritual lit RPG, right? And you mentioned this thing of, well, someone dying of like the premise of one of your books is like someone dies of cancer and then gets sent to another world. And I wrote down like this very short thing called like reincarnation myth, right? Now I'm going to like do a little bit of a detour. There's this guy called, let me just get his name. David Atterbury, not to be confused with David Attenborough, who spent his life in academia writing literature and write papers about fantasy literature. And he basically postulated that fantasy literature is modern myth-making and just as necessary as stories about the real world that are kind of like depressing a little bit. Like one thing that I always find very interesting is that people call Neil Gaiman's books mystical realism when it's just urban fantasy, right? But no, it's urban fantasy if you can get it for a dime. Like that's the whole difference. There's a lot of these isekai novels that we write are takes on, you know, paradise, right?
Yeah.
Their takes on Valhalla, right? So I thought, like, have you integrated stuff like that in your story? Like, because you started out on this premise.
I think it's mostly subtext rather than explicit text. But I'm a relatively religious person in real life. And that concept of like this promise of something that fixes things after your life is over, even if your life doesn't go well, here's this thing that will eventually come in and fix it and it'll all turn out right in the end, is easy for me to suffuse into it because I've grown up in that particular, what for some people would be a mythos. So I don't think it's necessarily me going, I never hint that those people are not fully alive again, if that makes sense. But it is something where it's like, I recently rewatched the show The Good Place.
Oh, I love that show. It's so good.
I think about it constantly when I'm writing these books, because so much of it is, what if you showed up to this place and it was different than you expected? Like it appeared to be one thing, especially with Dead World. Like you were promised heaven and here is a form of hell. And what can you do to fix that? was definitely a huge premise there. So I think about it when I write it. I don't want to say it's an explicit thing in the books, because I think if you went looking for it, you probably wouldn't find it. But yeah, I think about it a ton.
That's a very good point. So, I mean, thinking about Isekai War, right? And the idea of that being like paradisical, the scene always comes to mind is the first scene in He Who Fights with Monsters, because Jason gets pulled to this other world. And this is just stereotypical. This is just like for most other Isekai novels, right? It almost always starts in a glade.
Yeah. You right? have to have a calm place to... But he's
calm place.
He's almost immediately, because it's a glade in a cultist compound, if I remember right.
Exactly. And it's like, it's a little bit like that, right? It's Garden of Eden, but just a veneer of it, right? Yeah. It's actually in the middle of a desert. And there's like, the first thing he sees is like this like wild rabbit just tries to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's always that thing of like, we've been promised paradise and we're not getting it. Right. Yes. So why not? What's up? And the other example of this, like if this is, hey, rewards in the next world, right, then system apocalypses are the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Because that is you are trapped in this world. There is nothing after it, or maybe there is, we don't know. But if you're thinking about it, everything in every system apocalypse ever is just taking reality and cranking it up to 11. Whether that's Bymort, whether that's Dungeon Crawler Carl, whether it's Apocalypse Me, I'm blanking on more here.
How to Survive at the End of the World by R.C.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, yeah, by R.C. Joshua, right?
That's, great contemporary genius, R.C. Joshua.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I hope I get that guy on the podcast someday. Right. But that's all about like the absurdity of what we experience in our real lives, and then kind of cranking that like up to a maximum, where suddenly people always giggle about the subway level in DCC, but I've never seen something more like that. That is just genius on so many levels. Like the whole like being trapped in a job commute thing, coupled with like addiction to drugs, coupled with like the murderousness of being trapped in a machine. And like at the end of the line, in many ways, it just all ends in a void. Like, God damn it, Matt, who hurt you? But also, thank you. Right? It's...
And as a tool too, I mean, there's something to be said for people who can do this well, taking something like that is instantly relatable and understandable to the reader, and taking all the elements of that let them shortcut understanding issues and let them shortcut like, this is what's going on, this is what's happening, and still making that into its own thing, still making that into, because it's not just a subway level. Like he could have done the same story beats in a ton of different settings, but the subway lets him focus on the cool stuff. Like him saying, this is a subway thing, you understand what that is, here's where it's different and neat, is a whole thing that I really respect. Yeah.
I like subway. It's really good. Jumping into the next question.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best advice you've ever gotten as a writer?
Oh, so this isn't even from a fiction guy. This is from a nonfiction writer who I disagree with on almost every point he writes about. But he's a tremendous writer. His name's Freddie DeBoer. He's not super duper famous, but he's known. And he put out a guide for writers who wanted to write nonfiction mostly. And his advice was, the field is so incredibly crowded now with different writers that you're going to have people come in who will tell you in that crowded field that what you should do is follow these 100 rules, these 20 rules. Like, here's things you never do, here's things you always do. And he says you should flat out ignore every single one of them. And I absolutely agree with that, because we're all rolling the dice on, I think, will we find people who read our stuff and enjoy it? And they have so many choices now that the only thing that you can really offer people is the way that you yourself are weird. And it's not a guarantee. Like, you may not find people who identify with the specific way you're weird. It may not find its audience. But if it if it is going to find an audience, and it is going to do really well, like Dungeon Crawler Carl did not find its audience by following a lot of the specific rules for making very standard cookie cutter fiction. He fights with monsters. And they did it because those were the books that they were supposed to write. You can feel them in it, I think. And leaning into your personal weird, I think it's not a guarantee of success, but it is necessary, I think, for it.
Yeah. Not a guarantee of success, by the way. Very, very apt, right? We were talking about other books before, but like, and also, like, again, like, we've also talked about trying to gauge success of books on Railroad versus on Kindle Unlimited. And while there is like an overlap, I think Rhett Bruno, one of the owners of Aethon, was the first person to really capitalize on that, where he discussed, like, the people who are on Railroad have pretty much the same taste as the people who are reading books on Kindle Unlimited. So there's like you can make some assumptions there, right? And that's how Aethon started. So just because you're writing weird stuff doesn't mean that people are gonna like it, right? You gotta find the right people for your book to like, people that would like your book, basically. So I am, I'm still thinking about a lot of stuff in this case. And
I'll add to that sometimes those people don't exist yet. And sometimes your brand of weird is the right thing and your writing skill isn't there. But the people who, I mean, there are plenty of stories of people who have written 5 books, 10 books before they got themselves to the place where it could hit, and they found the audience where it could hit. And then they did quite real well.
It's really harsh of you to shout out small indie authors like Brandon Sanderson like that.
He's done well since.
Yeah, I think so too.
He's a rising star.
Yes. He's right. I think he's like he's going supernova pretty soon. But the thing that you said about rules, though, is, and I want to align this, there's wisdom at the core of every rule. But right, rules are bad. Like, all rules are bad, but sometimes they're helpful. It's like show, don't tell. Like, that thing has like so many layers that you need to unwrap before you actually understand this. But it's also good advice for people on different levels of different skill sets if you keep thinking about it.
Yeah.
So people at the start of when they're writing, some people go like, he felt bad. Like, can you show us how bad that was, right? So you can say, like, it felt like he was being stung by bees in his stomach.
Well, and the American jazz sort of metaphor that they use is you have to know the rules before you can break them, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I have seen, and I think we've all seen, people who have said, hey, come read my writing. And you go read it, and they're trying to break the rules without knowing them.
Yeah.
And it's some of the worst stuff you'll read sometimes. And I say that brutally because I love these people and they're trying. But at the same time, like, there's mistakes on both sides. Some people over fixate on the rules and then they can't do anything. And I think the people who are really successful are the people who have a good enough grasp of the rules, but also have that self-confidence to then try something different.
There's a concept of shuhari. It is from, I think it's Chinese or Japanese martial arts. I'm never quite sure. And it's been wildly used in agile coaching circles. The idea is that it's first you learn the rule, then you adapt the rule, and then you are the rule, right? Mm-hmm. So learn the rule, break the rule, be the rule. And it's very important to know where you are in whatever aspect you're doing. It's basically like a thing that tries to avoid the Dunning-Kruger effect, where Dunning-Kruger means you
frame of think, reference.
Yeah, if you're not good at something, you think you're better than you actually are. Think of Karate Kid, for example, right? Mm-hmm. At the start, he's like, yeah, just go paint that fence. He's like, what? Like, wash the car, right? Wax on, wax off. And then he doesn't even understand why the rule's there. He just follows it. And then because he's integrated the rules so well, he can like, oh, this is how I use this. This is nice. This is very good. And then he comes into the ha phase. And then later on at the end of the series, he really makes his own rules. He makes his own fighting moves and all that kind of stuff. So if you're thinking about it like that, try entering a karate tournament without ever having done karate. Okay. And it's like, you punch people in the face, how hard can it be? Right? You either get disqualified or you get punched in the face or both.
Well, and to put that into practical advice for people who are like trying to write or get started writing, like there's a going back to Japanese meta, like doing stuff sort of metaphors. There's a Go proverb that's like, lose your first 100 games as fast as possible. Because you aren't going to be good when you start out. Like, you just aren't. That's fine. Nobody is, right? When they start out, everybody learns, everybody practices. But like, if you can, for me, I mean, I've written 700,000 words in like 8 months or something crazy.
Oh, nice.
And I have gone from in like maybe 2 years ago being like, how do dialogue tags work again? Like, how often do you use them? Like that level where it's just sort of puzzling over how a sentence works in some ways to now there's a lot of stuff I'm really just a lot more comfortable with. That's pretty acrobatic because I've written so many words down and you have to get those. Start out with the rules, learn them, but then get them ground into your muscle memory and do it with word count.
While we're at this topic of like understanding and learning stuff, what's one thing that you learned and either now do differently or would do differently?
I am a very seat of the pants author. And there are a lot of ways in which that has been fine for me. But what I've learned in the past, like probably 6 months, a year, is you can't do it entirely. And I pulled away from that really hard when I first started writing a lot of fiction, because I had seen so many people get caught up in world building that they did not actually get around to writing any stories. They built a lot of worlds and then they were empty little ghost towns of no stories happened, no writing happened. And then over the past, you know, seven novels, I just finished up seven, today. I realized that there are failings. I needed to actually stop every so often and go, where am I at? Where am I going? What's going to make sense to get me from point A to point B? And I really needed to get that down on paper more. And that I think is sort of niche. Most people do plan more than I do. So I think it's sort of niche advice, but just finding out that I couldn't really abandon here's my beginning, here's my middle, here's my end, here's at least a couple intermediary steps to get me there. And, you know, I think in our pre-call recording, we talked a little bit about I had to do a big retcon recently.
Yeah. I would love to hear about that.
Yes.
I want to like kind of like juxtapose this with my own experience with this, because I started out as a plotter. Because I thought this is how you do it. I hated it. I got very stuck and I was like, oh, these characters don't do what I want to do. This is weird. Then I went complete pantser and just wrote. And that then turned into like this recurring loop of like the same emotion over and over and over again, because I didn't like re-reference what I did before. It was too much. This also wasn't good. So what I do now is I kind of have the entire thing plotted out in like very, very like record things, like this cool scene needs to happen, then this, then this, then this, and this. And then while I'm writing, I look at the next scene and I basically write a paragraph, and then I take each sentence of that paragraph and expand that into another paragraph, and then I have a chapter done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, for example, I like Sam wakes up, she walks upstairs, there's she needs to grab her weapon, but this and this happens. And then whenever I'm like, oh wait, this actually needs more space, I actually add even more sentences. I explode these things even more. This actually works super well for me because I don't have to read this stuff and go like, oh shit, I talked about this like yesterday already, so I need to like redo the entire thing. That saves me a lot of time. But you were saying retconning. Really would like to hear about that.
Yeah, I was writing Demon World Boba Shop. This was book one. I'm now just now done with book two. And it's a very, very soft slice of life, but I'm of the philosophy that there still has to be a plot in there. There still have to be some stakes, and they maybe aren't. I'm fighting a pack of dragon wolves with a mace stakes. Like, they aren't like that, but there has to be some tension, some place the story comes from. So without going too much into spoilers, one of the characters gets ill. And a bunch of readers, as soon as the character got ill, went, that came out of nowhere for us. There was nothing, no foreshadowing, no nothing. And in real life, that's how people get sick. So I didn't think of it at all when I wrote it. Like, you know, in real life, sometimes people just get sick and die in a day. But they said, as far as the story goes, it was a very jarring turn, and very almost painful to read in like a not in a dramatic good sense, but like in like, this chapter was very happy, this chapter is very sad, and we had no idea this was coming or even possible in this world. So I had to go back, and there were some complaints that were related to that. So I had to go back, and a lot of readers said this. There was a group of them who were basically saying, yeah, we all feel the same way on this. And I felt like I had to respect that. Go back, add in some foreshadowing, change a couple mechanical ways things worked. And then to do all that in a way where people who didn't go back and read the retcons would still be on the same story track, like to change details and things in a way where it would then fit without changing the trajectory of the story at all. And I think it was major changes to two chapters and minor changes to three or four others. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't luckily tens and tens of thousands of words. But it was good, you know, I mean, at least I think it was like a day to 2 days of work
to
do it the way I wanted to do it and really figure out where everything had to be adjusted. Because I didn't really plan, I wasn't really thinking, okay, this, I knew I was going to have some sort of tension near the end of the novel. It needed to be there. And when I got close to that point, I decided on it and jumped right in. But because I hadn't planned it, and I hadn't done the mental work on it, it ended up being all in the work, and it had to be fixed.
You know what time it is? That's right, it's a new ad. And this time I have two amazing stories for you to check out. First one is my friend Saving Throw, who writes a story called So When Am I a Hero? It's a system apocalypse that is quite frankly amazing. I don't like system apocalypses usually, and I devoured that one. So go and check it out. There's a link below the podcast. The second one is from another friend of mine, because I have two friends, called The Infinity Dungeon by Reject Humanity. Premise is actually pretty cool. Guy goes hiking on the Appalachian trails and stumbles into the only and first dungeon in the world, and he's the only person on Earth with a system, at least for a while. All right, go check him out. I appreciate it a lot, and I'll see you next time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think this kind of thematic foreshadowing is really important, right? So if people understand at the beginning of the story, when you're doing the promise, that bad things happen here, but it's going to be all right, right? That's a very, very hard promise to make, but it is also very important. So you have about like three or four chapters to like really nail that promise down. And I'm partially interested, or particularly interested, I should rather say, in the whole retcon thing, because I just retconned 36 chapters. So I took my the current version of Torchbearer, and that's on Royal Road, and it has some major problems because it basically didn't change from the first version. And I redid the entire start. I chunked out 20 chapters and added 36, and then rewrote the rest of the book. And that didn't take me 2 days, unfortunately. Yeah, it took me a little bit longer.
Did it hurt to do?
No.
It would have hurt me.
No.
That would have been painful for me to do on some of these. Even if it was bad and I knew it needed replacing, it would have been painful for me to cut out the tumor, so to speak.
I can see where you're coming from. I thought it would also hurt me way more than it did. But for me, it was like, just take all the stuff. I know where I need to go now. Like, this is the point where I need to integrate. So let's write to this point again. And then it was like, chucked everything out. I didn't even look at it. I didn't go like deleting it word by word, because like, it doesn't make any sense. Go in Scrivener, select everything, copy to a different folder, done. Like, let's get going. And then I turned those 20 chapters into 36. I added 60,000 words to the novel. But it's been good. But it took way longer than I thought to integrate those two streams coherently.
Yeah.
So that people were like, oh yeah, okay, I understand this. And even now I have characters in there that weren't in there before, and events that were important that I probably can reference in the second book, because the people who read the first book and don't want to reread it again, they won't know what happened there. But yeah, I'm probably just going to like not mention these people a lot. Not the most ideal way, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I think it's a good compromise, because, and you seem to have the same instincts as me on this. You have to respect the experience of the reader who has been with you the whole time in those kinds of improvements. And I think I respect the work, man, because for me to go back and do that chunk of work again would be, I'm already tired.
Don't tell Travis Baldry. Because he was like, I hate doing work twice. I never do work twice. I'm like, okay. Sorry, Travis.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I there are a lot of writers, I think. It would be interesting for me to see how some of the writers I really like a lot, who are on that like 5 a week or 7 a week release schedule, how they'd be on a 3 a week schedule, where they did have more revisions and they did have more time to revisit work. Because at the pace you have to write to make it up to the Royal Road, and there just isn't time for it for most people.
I mean, famously, Sherdaloon reduced his output from like 5 chapters a week to 3. And I think he's doing pretty well with that.
Yeah.
Right?
Last week I wrote 16, I think. And I had to go back this week and really review it very carefully to make sure the quality hadn't slipped. It's just an insane pace. And I'm in shape, like, so to speak. I have good writing cardio right now. And even then, it's like, you know, back in the day, people would work for years on a single novel.
Yeah.
And I write one every month or so.
Yeah. And like, I think this is something very particular to like our space, which is comparable to like pulp fiction, right? And like romance and all the kind of stuff, like very easy to churn through kind of stuff. And sometimes I think that maybe I'm also in the wrong space. Not like that I don't like it. I love it here. But I think that like I should probably think about like submitting my work to a trap publisher. Right, they have like shitty rates, but big advances. So
the distribution. Most popular pulp fiction of all time was written in your home country. It's a book series called Perry Rodan.
Oh, Perry Rodan, yeah.
Yeah. Is it Rodan? Not Rodan, but
Rodan. Yeah. It's Perry Rodan.
I've been trying to collect them over the years. I've got like five or six of them on my bookshelf right now. They're fun.
I got a sticker pack.
Oh, do you? Mm. That's fun.
It's super cool. Yeah. Like it's a first contact kind of sci-fi story for everyone who's like going. It's been going since like the 60s.
Yeah. Very powerful at the beginning. Very, yeah. Very much almost like an isekai novel. Like guy goes to the moon and then stuff kicks off.
Yeah. And it's, they were different, sci-fi very differently back then. And they rebooted the start also because it didn't hold up very well. And there were lots of like continuity errors, like lots and lots, because it wasn't just one dude writing these. It was like an entire series, like an entire team of people. And some of them had the Superman problem, right? So what can Perry do and what can't he do? And then they didn't read all the novels before and just wrote something new into that. And there's the silver editions, like I think they're calling them, where someone just goes through all the entire stuff and goes and edits everything. And then he was like, well, I saw it, but I had to like kick out this, and this. I just couldn't fit into the canon. Like I just couldn't. Like it didn't work. So enjoy the stories. I hope they're nice, but they're not canon anymore. So
yeah. They are for America, specifically in an American way. What they are German sci-fi Hardy Boys. They are formulaic, churned out, super interesting. Not always great, but always fun. They are fun little 10-minute read. You can burn through one of those novels in like 15 minutes.
But I think that's like a very, very good point and a very good tagline for Lit RPG in general. Not always great, but always fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like it. That's a good tagline, yeah. Okay, awesome. I have another question for you guys. For you, Guy. Tell me about one book that you love and why is it awesome?
I'm gonna very quickly touch on two. I mentioned one of these in the pre-call, so go get on the Crit RPG Patreon and get all that, because he deserves it and he's a beautiful.
Thank you. I think I mentioned at this point that RC Joshua also has a Patreon that you can check out.
Yeah, we do. And we launched a book, which I'll hopefully end a call. Can I plug it?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, cool. So we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. Right now, Warby Pickus's Slum Rat Rising, I think is it's some of the best writing in the whole realm right now. He's very good. It's always interesting. Even when the character's not in the most interesting part of the story, the writing holds it up. I think he's doing masterful work. I really, really like it. The setting is bizarre in a lot of ways. Mm. It is very non-standard, so I don't know if it'll fit for everybody, but the writing will get you, and it'll hold you. And I think in secondary to that, especially the beginning, maybe to the first like 100 chapters or so of Unintentional Cultivator. Yeah. Is it unintentional or unintended? I should be better.
Unintentional, I think.
Yeah, it just very, very good writing in like the sort of, it's cultivation, so it's not really lit RPG, but you know you don't always differentiate the two in your heads, guys.
Progression fantasy.
Yeah. And it's really the same thing there. Like especially with cultivation, like everybody's got a lot of the same beats, so it really matters a lot how good the writer is. And this just normally I've dropped cultivation novels by now, and every time it updates, I go, good, there it is. Now I can be happy for 15 minutes. I read for the writing more than I do for the story in a lot of cases, but both of those writers have both and are very good. And just real quick, just because he deserves it, even though he's been having some trouble and doesn't update, anything by Robert Blaise, anything he has done, is very, very good. And I know he's had some troubles keeping up with pace, but please go encourage Robert Blaise, because he is excellent. And I don't think he gets the credit he deserves for a lot of stuff. That's Jester of the Apocalypse, I think. And the new one, Lifesteal, 1% Lifesteal.
Yeah, there's, I forget his name, but someone recommended this recently to me. A very, very old school Roy Road stuff. It's called, this used to be about dungeons.
Yeah. Alexander Wales, he did Worth the Candle too.
Exactly.
Both, yeah. Solid writing. Little bit fetishy for me sometimes. Kind of like right on the line there. It's almost harem. It's quasi harem sometimes.
You said the H word. Oh.
But it's not gross. It's just, but I feel like I always want to warn people, but I mean, nobody has done better writing than Wales did at the beginning. Yeah. He had the space to do it and the talent to do it, and he just did very good work.
It's like some of his roles, I was like so fucking disturbing. Like, I think some of those roles would give like Matt Dinneman nightmares. Like, it's really like if you're into that kind of stuff, absolutely. It's also not always horror. So, Worth the Candle, pretty like, oh yeah, like oof.
It's, there were times where I almost stopped reading Royal Candle because he was good at, or Worth the Candle because he was good enough at making a stressful part of the story seem stressful that I got stressed.
Yeah.
And that's talent. That's talent.
That's my dungeon crawler card experience. But yeah, this used to be about dungeons is I think a bit more chill, like a bit more.
Oh yeah, it's slice of life. It's a lot more chill. I've read the whole thing. It's solid all the way through. It's slow.
The premise there is like you can only go into so many dungeons, and after some point you just kind of like stop going to dungeons because they get too hard, and you know go on and have a life and kids and stuff.
Yeah, and they're on they're very specifically on a D&D hex map.
Yeah.
So like there's one in every hex, so they have to travel a little bit further every time, and it's character driven. Very much so, and it's intentionally slow and just it's half slice of life, half action.
Yeah, very good. All right, cool. Well, this brings us to shout outs. I mean, like, you also like kind of put shout outs in there, right? So you kind of mix it up a little bit. So you mentioned you wanted to shout out your own books, or like prop your own books.
Well, I do want to plug them. Right now, the big one, if you're looking to support the thing, is How to Survive at the End of the World. That just launched on Kindle Unlimited, book one and two, with three shortly to come in the next month or so. Any help there, read it, review it, would be vastly appreciated. Dead World Isekai is still on Royal Road, all three books, and is free for about another month and a half. So if you want to read it for free, now's the time. If you want to read it on Kindle Unlimited or buy it, that's coming up pretty soon. Audiobook as well. And right now, the new one is Demon World Boba Shop. It is the slice of life. If you're looking to calm down, that's the one. And it's very honestly, it is the best stuff I've written so far. So if you're also looking for my current final form, it's me writing about a guy making tea.
Nice.
So
that sounds very interesting.
It's good. It's the one I like the most. I don't actually know if it's the best because I'm biased because I like it the most.
Yeah. I mean, like we talked about writing stuff that you kind of just chilly enjoy as a sort of, well, palate cleanser between writing about lots of gruesome stuff. And I think every author has that. I can't wait for Matt Dinneman's palate cleanser. But maybe that was like Kaiju Battle Surgery. Maybe that was his palate cleanser. I don't know. I will never know.
The chill vibes of Kaiju Battle.
The chill, absolutely. Man, it's basically I ran away to evil, just like a little bit more spicy. narrated by Heath Miller. the next question, or like the not the next question, but kind of adjacent to that, is did you see that Matt Dinneman got like a trad published contract?
I heard a little. I've been deep writing the last couple weeks, so I haven't seen a ton, but I heard scuttlebutt. I saw a little bit of it. That's which is fantastic for him.
Absolutely.
And I'm assuming, is it something, fill me in, is it something new?
Yes. It's, I think, I distinctly remember something about like a farmer's riot on some sort of planet. So it's a sci-fi thing. Mm. And it's standalone. It's like one book. And rumors abound about the exact specific amount of money he got for it, but it's a lot.
Yeah, well, good,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, let's, man, yeah. Let's all do a lot eventually.
Let's all do a lot of money, yeah. Like, I just kind of hope that, like, in the coming years, the RPG will retain this kind of free-for-all feeling. Because it's going away. All the big publishers don't really have that much. Like, we're all booked out. There's just so much stuff, right? So Aethon's pretty at capacity. I think Royal Guard's at capacity. Podium, I know for a fact, are at capacity. Or like getting pretty close to it, I should say. I shouldn't speak for publishers. But all right, so there's new publishers popping up everywhere because there's plenty of work going around. But also at some point, there's going to be market saturation. So we'll see.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think it goes one to two ways. Either it explodes into a more mainstream thing and then there's room again and more readers. I mean, the big winners will still win big, but there will be more to get. Or it just stays sort of at the side it is and the big winners stay the big winners and maybe every once in a while one of them retires.
Yeah, I mean, that's or maybe not, right? So I think Randedly Ghost Hound recently finished.
Mm-hmm.
So it's done. And I know that He Who Fights with Monsters isn't done. I think it's going to take a long time to get it done. But the series will have an end at some point. All right. Mm-hmm. So it's not an endless series, even though sometimes it looks like it.
Well, but, what I hate to say, because I wish that there was a way to cheat this, really, really good stuff will always win. It doesn't matter how saturated the market is. It doesn't. If I was writing true masterpieces, generational works, like... Mm-hmm. You know, I guess.
Yeah, maybe, right? It's there's a lot of luck involved too, right? So it's about finding the right market for your stuff, and then first of all, being lucky enough to know where your right market is, and then the right people reading that. Like my biggest example for how luck plays a huge role is Biggest Nicholas Wolfwood. You know him?
I know. I probably do. I have an inability to remember most names very easily.
It's you. Maybe you don't. He's a Twitter guy who has a Trigon Maximum fan account.
Oh.
And he was tweeting about the new upcoming live action thing. And then he tweeted like, by the way, go and read this book. Don't read anything about it. Just go and read it right now. Stop anything. And he posted a picture of, I don't want to butcher her name. Anyway, the book's called This Is How You Lose a Time War. It's a novella, pretty short. And it's won the, I think, Hugo Award like a couple of years ago. And overnight, that thing got like millions of retweets. And that book shot from like, I don't know, like spot 10,000 or something up to like number one on Amazon, like up the charts, right? And it became this huge self-propagating viral sensation, right? The other example that I have you read Cradle?
Actually, no. Believe it or not, it's on my list to read because I've been trying to get enough time to start it.
But everyone has heard about Cradle, right? Yeah. Even if you don't like it, like everyone's like, but have you read Cradle? It's because it's almost a meme, right? And at some point, the joke, like, just, I don't know, like this guy probably will write, earned a lot of money with Cradle. And I'm going to joke and say like half of it is because people want it to be another joke. Right? So luck plays a huge role in this. We talked before, like the bonus stuff. Or before the bonus stuff, I think even, about how certain authors just were at the right place at the right time,
mm-hmm.
right? And they're the first to admit it, So you gotta have everything. Good story. Decent enough skills for people to not hate the story. And luck that people talk about it, right? If a certain amount of catalysts, so people who talk about what they like, or early adopters, like very vocal early adopters, hit your story soon, and then start posting about it on like on these threads on Reddit, like, oh hey, I like this book. This was really nice. You're going to like slowly but surely gain a following. And that then self-perpetuates. It's super easy being like, yeah, this is YouTube talk about everything you watched. And he said, like, it's super easy being a billionaire. It's never been harder to be a millionaire, to become a millionaire, right? So you just gotta wait.
Yeah. And by the way, any influential tweeters in the audience, please feel free to rocket me to fame and ridiculous fortune, because, you know, I got nothing but time for that.
And when you get super famous, of course, you're going to like retweet the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I will put it in the back of the next book I put up on KU. I'll tell my editor, like, please put in a plug for Crit RPG, and
you can like put it in the front, like, dedicated to Crit RPG, the podcast that made me famous. That sounds like a very good idea.
When I'm giving the State of the Union address for the US, I will be like, by the way,
RC Joshua, poet laureate, there you go. All right, so this has been the Crit RPG podcast. Enough nonsense. Usually, I would say we're going to keep talking after this podcast is over, but we've already talked a lot before the podcast started, so probably this is going to be a bit shorter of a post show. Nevertheless, I really hope you enjoyed the show. Please do give it a like, a follow, rate it on iTunes or Spotify. That also helps a lot. Good ratings, of course. Bad ratings don't help a lot, but it's your choice. I feel hurt. RC, any last words?
We covered most of it, but I really appreciate you having me here, and it's been a whole lot of fun.
No worries, dude. Like, I really enjoyed the podcast too. Like, it was really, really good. Like, we talked, like I said, about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And yeah, if I didn't have this work meeting in a couple of minutes, I totally would like keep going with this.
Oh yeah, but absolutely. Well, and hit me up anytime you need another episode. It's a nice little break from the typing.
Yeah, I really wish I had more time to like bring people on again. Mm-hmm. But right now it's like doing one of these episodes is so it's the time in hours times two multiplied by the amount of people in the podcast. So sometimes like when I do these roundtable discussions with all the huge names about writing, sometimes these take like 8 hours to edit, and that's my entire day done. So this podcast will take about 4 hours to edit, so we'll see.
Well, it is immensely appreciated, dearly, so thank you.
And I'm doing it for fun. Like, it's still fun for me, and I'm still very much enjoying it. Okay, cool. Well, with that being said, thank you again very much for being here. And thank you for listening and or watching. And I'll see you next time. And if you're on Patreon, the show goes on for a little bit at least.